tech's going to evolve to the point where it's going to be hard to distinguish who's human and who's not human. And again, whether that's 500 years or 50 years remains to be seen, but it will be an interesting question for everybody involved, and does need and demand shift from humans to technology is going to be a really, really fascinating topic that I hope I'm too dead to consider.
Welcome to Lessons in Leverage, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of success. We'll help you unlock the secrets of leverage so you can amplify your impact in the world. Here is your host, Spencer Lowe.
Welcome back to another episode of Lessons in Leverage. I'm really excited today to be joined by Josh Polgardi. Josh is the founder and CEO of a couple of really cool companies. He started a business called Tripali, or am I saying that right, Josh? Is it Tripali or Tripali?
It's Tripoli is kind of the way people are tending to go, but it's got Trip and Ally right in it. So it's kind of, yeah.
Triple. Okay. It's all in. All right, Tripoli. So Tripoli, which is a networking app, it's going to be really exciting to dive into some of the stuff that he's doing to help connect people. We've talked in the past on this podcast about relationship leverage. He's going to be able to share some good insights there. But he's also working on a brand that I really admire called Luff Sheets. That's L-U-F-F Sheets, which is more than just selling sheets online. It's a brand with a purpose, and we love brands with a purpose. And so he's working to help the 2 to 3% of kids that are sleeping on the floor in the U.S. to get beds and sheets by donating sheets. Every time you purchase with Luff, you're donating two sets of sheets to these foundations and charities that are helping to provide beds and sheets to children in need, which is an amazing cause. So a wonderful person. And Josh, thanks so much for being on. Excited to dive into your story and share a little bit. Why don't you start by just sharing a little bit more background about yourself?
Yeah, of course. Well, first, Spencer, delighted to be here. I'm a listener and a fan, so keep up the good work.
Thanks.
A little bit about me, so folks know kind of where I come from. I grew up on the south side of Atlanta, kind of as a transplant. My mom's from Michigan, my dad's Hungarian immigrant, so it's just kind of like we were a little out of place there, but that is home, and we love it. And so I grew up there, went to school in Tennessee, studied history. I'd had aspirations to be a history professor. You know, I had all these people in my life that took the form of teachers and professors that gave so much to me. And I thought, hey, I would like to do that for somebody else. And it turned out to be a little bit of a delusion of grandeur, I think. That didn't end up working out for me. So once I kind of gave up on that dream, which is sad to say, but that's the cruel reality, is I kind of break up my career from college to now into two phases, really. I spent the first 8 to 10 years or so working with my hands. I was a window cleaner. I would hang from buildings. I would hang from ladders. I would brighten up your house or your office building. I was the guy on the other side of the glass, and I loved it. And to this day, it's probably still my favorite job. But at a certain point, I was looking at starting a family, getting married, and you start to have those weird thoughts creep in where you go, I don't think this is going to sustain me. I'm not going to have the retirement I want. I'm not going to have the things I want. I'm not going to have the time that I want. So I took probably about 6 months off, did some traveling, found myself in jail in Prague at one point, which was, by the way, not our fault. They let us go, and we were friends with all the folks in the jail. They were like, look, we're pretty sure you guys didn't do anything. We just got to see the video footage, and then we'll let you go. And we're like, great. So in that process of finding myself, I discovered that as an overeducated window cleaner with a deep history in writing, I'm going to go hit marketing. I'm going to take my writing skills, and I'm going to be a marketing mercenary. And so for the last 10 years, I've been so deep into marketing that I can't even see straight. And at a certain point, you get tired of building everybody else's dreams and businesses, and you want to start building your own. So I come to you today, Spencer, as a guy who just kind of said, had enough of this career-oriented lifestyle that looks like a job. And I'm ready to take risks that maybe previously I wasn't ready to take or was too scared to take. And now I'm here talking to Spencer Lowe.
I love it, man. Tell me about that breaking point, because that's always, I think, a big moment in people's lives, whether it's a breaking point of, I find that there's sort of this pattern, and sometimes it's certainly present in entrepreneurship, where there's this breaking point and it's like, I'm willing to go try entrepreneurship. But sometimes it's a breaking point that's like, I got to change something, and that leads to a long-term relationship, that leads to a new career or a new pursuit. And so it sounds like you had this big revelation, this big buildup where you realize, like, I got to do something different. What drove that? And what was that experience like for you?
Yeah, well, you speak a lot, of course, about leverage. And I found myself in a position finally with the right amount of leverage, either morally or financially or relationally, that I was able to go, now's the time, right? I have the flexibility from a financial perspective to take a little bit more risk than perhaps I did 5 years ago. Relationally, the people that I know now, the support structure I have now, lends itself to be able, well, such that I can build something that's meaningful for me and my family and the people that we serve. And then morally, I don't know if there's such a thing as moral leverage, but I was in a position where I chose to leave the marketing agency I was at because I was pretty sick and tired of how they were treating their customers. And I wanted out, and my wife said, look, we're trying to have kids. By the time we have a kid, there's no way you're going to be able to just up and leave. Now's the time. And I'm thankful to her for kicking me out of the nest that way. But all of those things sort of coalesced into this one mega reason for, quit being a pansy, Josh. Take a few risks. Start investing in yourself. And that's what finds us here today.
Well, that's really exciting. And I think those are common ingredients. I think, you know, if someone is wondering, okay, I'm grinding away at this job that I'm maybe not feeling fulfilled in, I'm not feeling happy, but I don't know how to change my life. Like, I don't know what do I got to do? How do I get from here to where Josh is? I think those are good building blocks you can start working on. Getting your personal finances in order gives you leverage, gives you that, takes you out of this mindset of, I must work. I've already planned where my money's going this month that I haven't even earned yet, but it's going to come in. Like, I'm building out this course right now for my employees that I'm going to teach, and I'm probably going to open it up more broadly. And it's a financial course, personal finance. And it's specifically because when your personal finances are in order, you can accomplish bigger things. This is like one of those building blocks of leverage in people's life that is common, I feel. And so I talk about in the course this concept of no longer seeing money through this lens of, I'm spending money I don't have yet and living off money that's already in the bank. And so it's a very small shift, and we go through tactics on how to do it. But once you make that shift, now it doesn't feel as scary, because I'm not like, oh man, if I quit my job, how will I pay the bills that I've already agreed to this month without the money that I thought I was getting this month? Like, you're just living, that's a form of debt, even though you're not paying interest on it. It's a debt to yourself, where you owe yourself money to be able to pay the things that you're obligated to pay that month. It's so stressful. And so the idea of being able to have higher leverage thoughts or start to build something bigger is just crushing, because you have no wiggle. And so I love that that was one of those building blocks for you. And then the second piece is, like, if you don't know anybody that's done it, or you don't know people that can support you while you're doing it, you don't have that system of relationships, it's so much harder. So I love those two big pillars. And then, you know, an inciting event like your wife kicking you out of the nest is always helpful.
it's a big morale booster for sure. Now, two practical examples of what you're talking about in terms of being financially responsible is nothing more than a way to give you options. So, for example, I've wanted a Toyota Tacoma for 20 years, right? I've always wanted one. It's just my weird thing. I don't want a Ferrari.
Great truck.
I always wanted one. And so my wife would come downstairs to the office, and I'm eyeballing a, you know, oh, what's a used one going to get me? What's a new? She's like, just get the truck. We can get the truck. And I was like, you know what? I don't want to yet, because what that payment or what that check I stroke, what that resembles to me is I'm stuck in this career that I don't like, meaning I don't have an option. So I chose in that moment, not in my sincere wisdom or profound, you know, intelligence, I just chose one thing over another, which is, I could have a really cool truck that I've wanted for two decades now, or I could have that and so much more later, by creating options for myself to not be stuck in this career. And I already forgot my second example of what you're talking about, but
that's okay. That's a perfect point right there, which is one of the reasons personal finance is so hard for people is that we all, as humans, this is just a universal truth, we struggle with decisions where the results are so far in the future or just not proximate to us. When we're making decisions that have short-term incentives or rewards, but long-term costs that are not very proximate or not very easy to conceptualize, it's so hard to make the right decision. Your brain's not wired to process that well out of the box. You got to do some software upgrades and you need tactics to make those feel more proximate. It's like one of the tactics I teach friends of mine is when you're going to make purchases, the hardest thing, if you're ever tempted to make a purchase out of investment money, like, oh, instead of investing, whatever. So let's just say they're beyond some of the baby steps. They're already investing a percentage of their income on a regular basis, which is like, that's a foundational basic you got to get to. So if you're out there, that's okay. We can help you get there. But once you're doing that, people will get tempted like, ooh, I've got this, say 10% or 20% of my money that I'm putting in investments, but just for a few months, I could use that to buy this car or whatever. If you just take that and plug it into a calculator and say, how much is that 30 years from now or 40 years from now when I retire? It's like, sure, it's $20,000 today, but maybe that's $800,000 compounded over 35, 40 years.
Right.
Am I willing to spend $800,000 on this car? No, I very clearly would not spend $800,000. $20,000, especially if it's broken up into payments over the next 3 years, feels so easy. And so we have to use tactics to start to get our brain to compare what's the real cost? What's the real cost of outcomes? And it's the same way with taking risk, whether that's an entrepreneurship or a new phase of your career. Part of what makes it so hard is we have this known short-term perceived loss of, I'm not going to be getting this paycheck that gives me these short-term benefits. But we have a hard time understanding what we're giving up in potential upside or growth or opportunity or learnings or experiences of going out and trying this new thing. And so people, we use this word risk to say, oh, that's riskier. But it only feels riskier when we're comparing the known short-term loss to the ambiguous long-term gain. Once we put it in more finite terms of, I will for sure out of this long-term project at least increase my marketability, increase these skills, like, failure of going out and trying to start my own business or doing this other thing still represents all this growth that's worth XYZ, all of a sudden it's more risky to stay in my current job or to stay unhappy. I mean, if we put a value around living a life that feels unfulfilled and really not happy, even 5 more years, all of a sudden it's like, what would I be willing to give now to go take a chance on a new career or a new job or a new entrepreneurship venture, something that's going to be fulfilling to me? Man, those are the things where we just can't conceptualize the long-term cost versus the short-term incentives. It's just like diets. So easy to eat the sugar because it immediately hits you with the dopamine. But then you're like, dang it, long-term, I'm going to be fat. Like, how do I balance this? And here I am 5 years later and I was 30 pounds heavier. So I got fat because I just gave in too much to the short-term. So I had to rewire my brain to every time I see sugar, be like, that's fat 10 years from now. Like, so if I do more than this amount, like this amount is not fat. This amount is fat, and I hated being fat. So what, now I got to rebalance how I'm making the decision. So it's like trying to get these tactics to make things much more proximate helps our brain evaluate more rationally, but it's just hard to do.
Yeah, definitely. And it's difficult because it's not as easy as a calculator. It's not this now or that later. There's prospecting involved. There's a little bit of, hey, how's this going to go? Which way is the market going to turn? If I buy this rental property instead of buying this truck or whatever, what's that going to look like? Are we going to have a COVID explosion or are we going to have a 2008 melt? Be upside down. Not only that, but it seems useful to establish a moderate baseline for how you want to live today. Because it's not all, you know, what set of golf clubs can I get when I'm 67? Like I want to live well today as well. So what I've done, and thankfully I'm pretty simple, right? I don't need a lot of things. So I can establish a relatively low baseline of, I need fly fishing stuff, I need a pickleball paddle, I need a laptop, and I need to feed the dog, right? And pay the mortgage. So those are the things that make me happy. And once I have that baseline, I can take everything in excess within my level of income and go, hey, how can I invest that in the most responsible way such that my future does look bright? And I think a lot of people get lost or don't acknowledge that nuance.
Yeah, no, I tell people personally, this is not the actual math in my portfolio, but I live half for today and half for the future because the future is not promised. So that carries over to my finances, and there's a certain percentage of my finances that cover what I call my fixed costs. There's a certain percentage that is spending today for joy, for fun, and there's a certain percentage I'm going to invest. Once you establish those, and I should say invest and give, because both those are long-term but also bring happiness. So there's donations and contributions, there's investments. We don't ever touch those. Those actually come out first. And then we have all the spending for right now, which my goal in the spending for now portion of my money is, how do I take my fixed costs I have to spend, make that as small as possible, because those generally don't materially make me feel happy. In fact, any bill or recurring cost makes me not feel happy. So the less of those I have and the more I'm choosing what is going to maximize my happiness this month and spending on travel, on fly fishing, or whatever that those fun things are that I love, well, that then I get more out of the same amount of money. So that's a very high leverage financial mindset. It's like, as long as I can follow some guardrails and keep my long-term interest protected, make sure I'm doing the other things that I need to be doing, then I'm able to allocate a larger and larger share of my money towards the things that make me happy. And that's a big part of getting the right mindset around quote-unquote budgeting or financial planning or anything like that. Is people look at it as a net negative for a lot of reasons. When you can transition it to what you just described of, wait, I can make my money go further. I can get more happiness out of the same money. And here's the skills and tools to do that. So I'm not bleeding money into things where marketers or companies are sort of tricking me into just parting with my money for stuff that doesn't really make me happy. But I know if I go fly fishing, it's going to be great. Or if I spend money on this type of thing, I always enjoy it and get happiness out of it. It's like that sort of happiness per dollar of allocation. That's a huge factor. And that's why you got people that on the same money are either miserable and drowning in bills and hate their life, or feel super free and are loving their life and getting a sense of happiness. Money's the same. So there's so many skills in there to unpack. But anyways, we could talk forever about personal finance. But it encapsulates some of these core leverage skills that once you get that, now you're like, I'm resilient. I'm not dependent on my employer. And if I'm not dependent on them, would I still stay? Sometimes the answer is yes. I love my employer. I love our mission. I love what I'm building. I love the skills and experiences I'm getting. I tell my employees all the time, like, I want you to stay here because I make it the best, most exciting opportunity for you. Not because you're like, oh, I'm not going to be able to make my car payment this month if I don't, have this job. That's a miserable way to live. So,
right.
So being in the driver's seat of your life is such a different feeling. So it sounds like as you were in the driver's seat of your life, you're like, okay, I'm going to go out and start a business. I'm going to take a risk before we have kids. What was that first venture? And what did that feel like for you as you started into that?
Yeah, well, a little preamble to that is I didn't know. So when I stepped out, I said, this is the right decision for me. And 2 months from now, I don't know what I'm going to do. I've got thoughts, but I don't know. So what I did was I did a test, and I didn't know I was doing a test at the time. But in retrospect, I went, oh, that's very interesting. So what I did was I said, hey, LinkedIn, if you know me on here, I've got a certain skill stack, and that skill stack may be available or helpful to you. I would like to make myself available twice a week at these times. Here's my Calendly link. If you want to ask me something or talk about something, I'll do everything in my power to help you out. Stream. If you know somebody, tag them. Like I just want to talk to people and put myself out there. And I don't consider myself wildly influential or even popular or even likable, but for whatever reason, I filled some of those spots, and those conversations I had, I ended up launching 3 businesses out of, because, and they were all people who knew me already. Like I got no quote unquote leads. It was just people who said, oh, Josh is open to talking about something outside the context of our typical relationship. And what that resulted in is a marketing consultancy, Luff Sheets, which thank you for the shout out to that as well. And then Tripoli, where we are really questioning the notion of networking and the way it's perceived right now, and trying to challenge that and give people a better way to do what I did, which was talk to people, build genuine relationships. So with that preamble, I actually forgot your initial question.
That's okay. You answered it. It's really looking at sort of that transition for you, what that was like. I love the fact that, sometimes sales or marketing or building a business can be intimidating. There's such power in just starting with your own network, creating space for the conversation. I love how you just created space and then saw what came of it, and that opened up opportunities you didn't even know were there in your existing network. because you've decided to take on networking, because that's a space you're passionate about, I would love to hear your thoughts about, you know, how did that then evolve? Like as you started to build these businesses, was that the reason, as you saw the power of your network, was that why you created Tripoli? Or what then started to be that driving purpose or reason behind Tripoli? Because I'm super passionate about relationships and networking, and it's part of the reason I have this podcast. I love meeting entrepreneurs. I love getting to hear and learn from their stories and meet them. And I love going to events. Disproportionately now, I spend money on being in places with the type of people I want to be in. You know, people talk about spending money on yourself. Early on, that's probably books, and that's learnings and skills and development and things like that. But as you advance your career, really the biggest thing you can do is put yourself in a position to build the right relationships. So what have you seen on that front as you started to build and shape Tripoli?
Yeah, so it was always a networking app, right? Let me give you a little background on what it is. Tripoli is just an app where if you want to meet people who are interested in the same things you are interested in, you can just meet them. Like you don't have to do any of this pomp and circumstance and, you know, personal brand building and list building and all the stuff that you see going on LinkedIn and social media. If I see Spencer Lowe, he's in my town, I'm interested in what he does, and he's also open to meeting one-on-one for networking, and he agrees to it, I could just meet you. As opposed to all the other grand falloon, if I'm using the word right, around our personal brands, because I've found so much value, but that's not the right word. My quality of life has improved so much because of people. But initially, I wanted to live the entrepreneurial lifestyle. This is where the idea came from. It's like, I see these people, they're designers living on a boat off the coast of Australia, digital nomads, and they fly to Bali once a month. And I'm like, all right, I'm not a Rockefeller. Like, how do you do that, right? I could never get into that tier of entrepreneurship, I didn't feel like. So I wanted to live that lifestyle. And I said, hey, how about this? This is where Trip Ally or Tripoli comes from. It's like, hey, if Spencer's out in California and I want to go meet Spencer, and that's a business trip, I'm going to go take a business trip and go hang with Spencer, and I'm going to write the whole thing off. We got a lot of feedback on that idea. And it turns out that travel and the entrepreneurial lifestyle, they're great things, but they're not the real. What people are having a hard time doing is blasting past what we're calling digital networking and into something that looks like a relationship. So I spent a long time thinking, it's like, interesting. You don't feel like you're meeting the people you want to meet on LinkedIn. You don't feel like you're meeting the people you want to meet even at your local networking events, you know, where you show up. Well, I'm an introvert. So first of all, I show up alone. That's a huge achievement for me. Second of all, I show up and I get pinned up against a column by a drunk guy in a cowboy hat who won't stop talking about his business. And I just spent the last 45 minutes doing the opposite of networking. Like I've ruled out this guy. Like I want to meet other people in the room, and I've got the bravery to do it, and I can't. And the shortcomings with those two styles of networking really led us to this place we are now, which is on Tripoli, you can pop open the app and see a list of people in your town who are serious about networking, serious about meeting people, and are seriously open to meeting you if you just want to and ask them.
I mean, that's such an important concept. As I'm thinking about that, I sort of had just a little mini realization myself here, thinking about networking. Networking really changed for me once I was a little bit more successful as an entrepreneur. And what I realized is, just now, really, is that the reason networking with entrepreneurs is so much fun is you pretty quickly can get lost in admiring what they do. And you almost have this underneath your soul, you kind of have this certainty, like they could help me someday, but I don't need to worry about that right now. Like they might be able to help me in the future, but I don't need to try to get something. I can know from them, celebrate what they've done, admire it. I might learn something along the way, share some things I've done, offer value to them. And that'll work out good for me long-term, because this is the kind of person that when you help them, they probably are going to help you at some point. And I don't need to keep a ledger or anything. And yet then I think about all the people that hit me up on LinkedIn that are just like, hey, really want to get to know you. And I'm like, business development at whatever. I'm like, no, you don't. You want to sell me something. you'd have been better off just sending me a pitch or saying, here's the problem we solve. Can I talk to you about it? And I'll tell you if I have that problem or not. But there's no part of me that believes that you want to help me other than if I will buy your thing. And so there's this layer we all have of what do we believe about the other person and their expectations. You know, Tony Robbins talks about this in terms of the way we treat relationships when we think it's leading to something new versus coming to an end. So like when we're just falling in love with someone for the first time, the way we'll let, you know, every little quirky thing they do is cute and it's fun and it's whatever. It's like, versus if we think we're headed towards a divorce and it's like, that's annoying and that's the worst thing and they always do that. Our brain totally reshapes the narrative around each relationship based on these underlying assumptions we have. And so, yeah, I love the idea of an app that can help us maybe make different assumptions and come in really feeling and believing that we can help each other, that it's worth getting to know each other, whether or not we can do anything in the short term for each other. Because it's been an interesting realization that in certain circles, that is like the standard. And so it becomes really easy to network. And then in other circles, you feel your walls go up and you're like, this is not networking. This is you trying to get shit from me.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's whole systems and schemes around how to, which you have to pay for, by the way. I can't recall their names. But in order to get value out of your network in that context, A, you have to pay. And B, you have to bring something to the table. And that's part of their system. And I'm over here thinking, hang on a second. I just want to get to know you. I am willing to be generous by default if you've earned that sort of currency with me. And we could just do that without any overlords of any type. And furthermore, yeah, to your point about LinkedIn is I'm an admirer of the platform. However, it's not networking. I see almost zero networking on the platform. It's list building, it's personal brand building, it's PR, and then it's sob stories. Like it's social networking in a way that has no real or not the business value that I'm trying to get out of my personal network. Which, by the way, all of those things are valuable. If you have a brand to build, for sure, do that stuff. Talk about what. But if you want to get to know people, let's say you just graduated and your network is zero, and I've been there. And then I spent the next 20 years of my life thinking that, oh, by me liking and commenting on some stuff on LinkedIn, I'm going to, not true. I spent 20 years building my network the hard way, which is you show up, you tuck your shirt in, you shave, which thankfully I don't have to do anymore. And you try to make people like you and you try to make people trust you. And then at the end of two decades, you find yourself finally in a position like I'm in, where I said, hey, I've got enough relationship leverage to start pursuing some businesses and start making some free choices that I didn't have 10 years ago when I was stuck in that cubicle. So the value, to your point, Spencer, and I think we're kindred spirits in this way, is that I think there's a lot of people who experience networking the same way you do, which is you get fascinated with somebody else's story. You learn from them. They learn from you. You give to them and they give back. This without the ledger. It's just, I heard a quote recently. He's like the godfather of network. Can't pull his name because I'm on camera. But he said, basically, the number one rule of networking is give and expect nothing in return.
Yeah. Yeah. And so much easier to do that when your underlying beliefs and assumptions are right. You know, one of the groups that I joined in the past year and I've had really good experiences with is Tony Robbins Platinum Partnership Group. It's a networking group. And it's more than a networking group because you also get to go to all his trainings and conferences. So I've got a lot of value out of the group. Of the different groups I've been a part of, that's been one of the highest value ones. And I've also found it's the easiest group to network with. And one of the reasons is because when you're there, what you know about everyone else there is that you have similar values. Because Tony Robbins ends up teaching and talking a lot about his beliefs and values and who you are and what you're trying to become. And so when you find yourself in an environment where you're like, hey, these people want to become the kind of person I want to be. You know, you see that in religion as well. You know, if you have a really strong religious affiliation, you're like, these people believe the stuff I believe. They want to become who I want to become. And so any sort of affiliation like that, where you can start from a perspective of, you want fundamentally the same things I want, and we have these same values. We're trying to make similar impacts in the world. We care about the same things. you don't actually have to care about all that. You don't have to be perfect. You might disagree on stuff. You might have different politics. But if you can start from that point of what you have in common, that shared set of values, it's so much easier to want to help that person because you're like, you know, you're a good person. Even if you vote for the guy I don't like, you are a good person. You know, I remember there was an election a while back where I told people who I was going to vote for, and they're like, that's totally outside of who you would normally vote for. I said, yeah, but that guy, I actually disagree with 80% of what he says, but I love his values. That's someone that I trust, his character. And that really matters to me. Increasingly, that's not really how people vote in politics. But to me, I was like, I'd rather have someone I disagree with who has the right character leading me in any context, not just politics. If I'm a leader at work, you know, church, anything, if I'm in a context and I'm following the leader, I'd rather that they be wrong about stuff, but really have the right set of values, love, emotion, caring, all that, than they're not trustworthy, they're liars, they're bad people, but they say the things I want to hear. Because how do I ever trust that person, you know? And so in networking, it's the same way that you can develop trust so much more quickly when you have that set of shared values, shared intentions. Doesn't have to be across everything, but some core values that you can really relate to each other on. And then you want to give, because now you're like, if I never get anything back, at least I helped someone that I care about. You know, it's just like family. How much do we do for family with no expectation of return? Well, it's because you care about it. And so I think that's part of the trick for me. And I'm realizing that even more as I'm just learning from you here, is that I've got to find ways to connect that way in environments where that's not the default, because then it makes it easier to give and it makes it easier to learn, to love, all those things that make networking fulfilling. Have you experienced that? Or you think I'm way off base?
No, you're absolutely right. And some of the best relationships I've had have come from, A, come at it with the right intentions, B, be open to other opportunities, and these people will sense it. And if they share that similarity with you, they'll go, hey, Spencer, you really need to meet my buddy, Dave. A lot of what he's doing really harmonizes what you're doing. And now you know Dave. And now Dave represents a new set of opportunity to give to Dave and Dave to give to you. And your expectations are aligned. Your values are aligned. Because it comes through that filter of, hey, maybe Spencer trusts me and I trust Dave. And there's the transitive property of trust there. And you get to take a quality over quantity approach to who you know and how you're building your quality of life in terms of the people that are in it. And yeah, it totally resonates with me in that way.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that I've been most fascinated by is this relationship leverage that I've seen. And I just think, you know, another aspect I'd love to get your thoughts on is this idea that we are most comfortable networking with people that are tightly affiliated with our current networks, and yet we get the most value out of breaking out of those networks. Is Tripoli, is that the best way? Are there other tactics or things you've seen about getting out of just the same network of, I added one more person who knows all the same people I know, who has the same opportunities, who has the same skill sets, that sometimes it's hard to make that jump, but that jump for me has been the most valuable when I get into these environments where it's like, I'm networking with someone who I have shared values with, I like, and they're doing real estate. Or here's some people I just met recently who are building a huge YouTube channel. It's not anywhere near what I'm doing, but I can learn really interesting things and I can share really interesting things with them because our experiences are so different. Well, how do you think about bridging that gap into networking with people that maybe have very different skills, experience, or networks?
But yeah, I mean, it is rolling the dice. It's always rolling the dice, you know. So inevitably, to your point, we tend to develop networks that are proximal. So, you know, a couple of years ago, it's what office building am I in? Okay, what companies are in that office building? Okay, what city is that office building in? And then state, and then even region. You know, so for instance, I'm from the Southeast, and we have a certain perspective and a certain sensibility that lends itself to a certain set of outcomes. But then we saw COVID hit and the Zoom generation explode. And now all of a sudden we're working in a different way that really lends itself to expanding your reach. For example, you're on the West Coast. I'm on the East Coast in the Southeast. You have different perspectives than me. Now that things are so digital, we can at least start relationships digitally with the same referrals that we got or that we used to get locally. So when I was working at my marketing agency, we had a VA. And that VA is now introducing me to all kinds of people because I established the credibility with her that I was the kind of person that people would want to know and work with. And since then, this is opening up conversations with big real estate firms out of Texas. Or I mean, it's just endless. I call her for everything now because she knows everybody. You know, it's like, hey, I'm struggling with this. Do you know anybody who can give me some advice on that? And she'll go, heck yeah. And she'll extend my network via referral outside of my typical, you know, what 5 years ago would have been limited to my proximity out into even the world.
That is sick right there. I just want to pause for a second because I literally am now, that's got my brain racing because I don't think I've ever done this. Like I've sort of tangentially, like accidentally done this, but it's so obvious. It's so obvious. And I'm actually embarrassed as I hear you say it to think that I have not tried this more aggressively. I have always looked at networking through this lens of like, I got to go find the person. But like, obviously, ask the people in your network. And I'm sure I've asked at times, but I'm sure that is a very underutilized skill in my personal playbook of just go tell people. Like I have in the past told people, this is what I'm trying to solve. But just ask the follow-up question. Do you know someone who might have advice on that? Do you know someone who might be able to help me with that? And get a exponential increase in reach right away. Because whether or not they tell anyone, they go through their Rolodex and say, all right, who do I know I could make an introduction here? And if you've built up that relationship with them, they're going to want to help you. And so, yeah, I've probably very underutilized my network by not asking them for help of, hey, this is what I'm struggling with, or this is what I'm trying to do. Who do you know that could give advice? That's a fantastic tactic.
A 1,000% yes. And I can give you a very, very tactile example. Please. So Luff Sheets, right? There's a lot of things that go into e-commerce and DTC stuff. One of the biggest headaches is packaging. And my wife and I, it's a passion project for us. We've got months trying to figure this out. And recently, our very last thing was, hey, we need the perfect box for what we're going to be shipping. And we spent weeks trying to figure out, okay, this size, this material, this color, this print, all this stuff. And we weren't happy with any of it. I mean, we probably have a combined 80 hours worth of box research under our belts. Now we're box experts and we're still without a box. So I called up a former coworker who's still a friend. I said, hey man, you know, anybody in packaging? And he goes, oh yeah. Buddy of mine owns a box factory. And I was like, what? I thought he was joking because it was so ludicrous. The first person I asked has a buddy from college who owns a box factory. They hadn't talked in 10 years and they bumped into each other 3 weeks ago inside of like a Kroger or whatever equivalent grocery store you have. And I'm mailing a check to this guy for our boxes tomorrow.
Mm.
And he specializes in smaller companies. Like he's not Uline. He's not selling a million boxes, you know, to Walmart. He specializes in. So in terms of problem solving and being able to ask people in your network a question for, hey, I need a resource. The internet isn't everything. You know, like you can't solve all your problems there. At some point, you need to know somebody. At some point, you need to pick up the phone and ask for help to solve a problem. And more often than not, you'll find that people are really, really excited to make that connection. They trust you and believe in what you're doing. So there's a little anecdote that supports this notion of ask your network for help.
Yeah, that's huge. I had just this last weekend, I had to sort of cancel my whole weekend and drive down to a property that I'm invested in to help get it over the finish line so it can go live on this Friday. So we had to do a bunch of manual labor and I was just trying to help the founder get things where they needed to be. And so I reached out to my network and I asked for help and people said, yes, we'd be happy to help. And three people that are friends of mine showed up. We all drove 4 hours south, did a bunch of manual labor all day. And, you know, I found some ways to hopefully make that worthwhile to them. But what I realized on the way down there was that I even said to him, I said, I'm so grateful you guys showed up because I don't generally ask for help. I usually am looking for ways to be the help. I feel like I've got a really blessed life and I'm in a good place to be able to help other people. And so it's a weird feeling to be the one that's like, I need help. And then I just thought, man, like, that's actually kind of unfortunate. Like, people around you want to help you. They want the opportunity to help. They want the opportunity to contribute. And it's kind of selfish in a way to not extend that opportunity. And so every time you ask, again, if you're not asking with expectation, if you're asking really because you need the help, you're wondering if they can help, you're giving them that opportunity to contribute, that can be really meaningful to people. And so why don't rob others of the opportunity to contribute, to help, to be a part of your success? It can be a little selfish. And so I never thought about it that way. But this weekend, I realized, I was like, I think the reason I'm so grateful is because I so rarely ask for help, but I also probably should ask for help more often.
Yeah, it's this weird ironic thing where I'm similar to you. Like I was going to say I'm a little bit prideful. I'm not going to call you pride.
You'll have it.
I've got that little bit of that of pride and self-sufficiency that doesn't lend itself towards asking for help very often. But ironically, it means when I do need help and the close people in my life acknowledge it, they won't give me a way out of helping me, right? First of all, they'll say, hey, we're coming to help because we love you and we're helping whether you like it or not. And I'll just go, fine. All right, you're right. Thank you. I should have asked. And then secondly, when you do go to ask, people go, hey, Spencer never asks for much. Like he is the guy that's pouring himself into his community, into his clients, into his family. Heck yeah, I want to help Spencer out. He's earned that from me, and I hate to put it in terms of currency, but it's true at the end of the day that when you don't ask for much and you do ask, you will get help because people genuinely do want to help you.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a beautiful thing. Again, if you're doing it with the right intention, the right purpose, because even in this case, it's like I'm invested in that property, but really we're going to help that company. You know, none of us are getting a ton out of it, but I actually told the guys that they were all going to get free stays there for coming. So I still made it worth their while, but they didn't know that. They didn't have that promise when we left. So, you know, it's which means a lot to me. You know, it means a lot when you can get that help, and we can give the help. You know, I tell people all the time, like, hey, just ask, you know, I really want to help. And then if they don't ask, I'll get mad at them, especially my close friends. Like, wait a second, what happened? And you didn't call me? You didn't ask? You didn't let me know? But it's this delicate balance. Certainly you can't ask all the time or ask with expectation, but you got to give people a chance to help you. So let's maybe move from that. I mean, I think this idea of relationship leverage, you've really hit on, I think it's a powerful concept, but I want to talk a little bit more about some of the other key lessons you've learned. I want to give you a chance to maybe, as you've been shifted into this entrepreneurship mindset, what are some of the highest leverage skills you've acquired or some of the foundational things that have made you successful?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of practical ways that you can apply the different kinds of leverage, and some of them are macro and some of them are micro. So what I struggle with is time. You know, I've founded three companies in the last year. And by the same token, I'm flooded with, hey, you need to read this book. Hey, you need to listen to this podcast. Hey, you need to be doing cold plunges for your mental health. You need to be listening to this guru about this topic who knows more about it than you do, and it's going to change your life. And there's a lot of pressure there where I can't get to everything I want to get to. So in terms of, let's just use technology as an example. Ah, here's a good one. You mentioned a book in a podcast recently that I listened to because I'm a fanboy now, and you're welcome. So I discovered that, hey, you could spend, I don't know, 37 hours reading a book. Or if Spencer recommends a book and I say, hey, why do you like that book? What are your three takeaways? I can then go to AI and go, hey, give me a summary of this book. These are the reasons I'm supposed to like it. Give me the core principles behind that. And it spits it out, and I've absorbed that content, that key driving point behind why this guy wrote this book, and I can apply it to my life. So for example, I think it's called The Undoing Project was what I looked up. And I said, okay, Spencer thinks that this is important for XYZ. And now I'm thinking about gain frames and loss frames. And now I'm thinking about how I make decisions for my business. So for example, I have to dump thousands of dollars into packaging for the sheets that we're selling. We're not doing it to get rich, but what do we stand to gain? You buy a set of sheets from us, we'll donate a set to these organizations that build beds for kids. Those kids stand to benefit. There's a set of sheets between these organizations building the beds and delivering beds to these kids, and they're having to purchase them out of pocket to the tune of thousands. Well, it's like, I'm not a rich man. I can't donate thousands of sets of sheets to you, but I do have enough IQ points to rub together to build a system where anybody who cares about this as a topic can get an awesome set of sheets from us. And in exchange, or in addition to that, a set of sheets will be donated to these kids of the same material and quality. Like they're sleeping the same way you do, which is like a baby in our sheet. So I lost my train of thought on that a little bit, but the point is, gain frame and loss frame.
Using AI and tech to try to get more done in less time. And then, the gain frame and loss frame of the undoing project.
Right. So I took that to heart, and it's changed my mindset from how am I approaching what a former Josh would have looked at as a risk averse kind of guy into a, hey, what's the upside of this? And go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. Finish your thought. I didn't mean to cut you off.
That's all right. Maybe that was my point. I've consumed the core principles of a book in about 60 seconds using AI. Yeah. So that's one.
I think that's a great shortcut for getting some of those key principles. And I mean, that book in particular is a fantastic one. It goes through a lot of lessons, but that particular lesson is one that really stuck with me about gains and losses. And there's this idea that again, Tony Robbins, I'm a huge fan of his, so I end up sharing a lot of things from him, but he says where focus goes, energy flows. And what I found about that statement is if you focus on the gain, you know, you talk about using gains and loss frames sort of to your advantage purposefully. It allows you to be more quote unquote risk tolerant. But the better way of describing it, in my opinion, is it allows you to be find certainty amidst uncertainty. And all of the upside is in the uncertainty. And so, in fact, another quote I love is, your riches or success in life is directly proportionate to the amount of uncertainty you can comfortably live with. And so there is this need, all the upside is in the uncertainty. And so there's this need to find, because we have a core need of being certain or feeling certain. And most people translate that into my job is my certainty or my whatever. I have a certain paycheck and that makes me feel certain about my life, whether or not my job is truly secure. I can feel secure. And if I feel that way, that's good enough. And so finding a way to feel secure or certain in the uncertainty is where you're able to get all the gain, all the upside. And I don't mean that just financially. I mean that in terms of impact. You know, with your sheets business, there's uncertainty. If you can comfortably live in that, you can have a much bigger impact for all these kids than if you just were to donate the sheets you can afford to donate today. It's like right. You get small impact and be like, oh, I donated 100 sheets or I donated, you know, whatever it was I could. Or I built something that can sustainably produce sheets long-term for these kids, hopefully in growing and growing numbers, and we can rally and I can bring others to the cause and we can all contribute together and we can produce this massive outcome. It's much more uncertain, but the upside is so much bigger. And
wait.
I love that element of this. Choosing to focus on the gains, choosing to focus on that will pull you into these areas where you can feel confident despite uncertainty.
Yeah, that is a great way to phrase that. And maybe a potential inadequacy in my technological leverage of using AI to summarize a book is because you missed some of those finer points, which is the level of detail that you just articulated it layered onto my existing understanding of the book. Maybe I need to go back to just reading the book.
So here's my advice on that, which is I would, if I was trying to develop a system because I didn't have a lot of time, I would combine your tactic with reading the book, but I would use AI to take the summary, have it suggest to me what it means or what the high takeaways are. And then if I decide that that's the thing or the set of things I need to know to get to the next level, then I'd read the whole book because it'll give me additional distinctions, additional clarity. They tell the story in several different ways. And so then I relate to it differently. I might get a little bit more of the depth, but the time investment is so much bigger. So if you're just trying to get like the big struggle with books is exactly what you said. It's the time. And so the answer to that for me has been, I just start reading a lot of books and I don't finish 80, 90% of them. I start reading and I'm like, this isn't helping. Move on. I'll come back to it later. Because I only even put books in my library that I think this could help or this might be really useful to me. But the reality of learning in general is it's got to be the right learning at the right time if it's going to have a real impact towards my results. And if I'm out here starting three businesses like yourself, I don't have time to do anything that doesn't help me get my result. I don't have time to be accidental about where my time's going. I don't have time to read a book and go at the end say, that was interesting. Like, no, right. I don't have much time for that. I can spend personal, just like fun time. If I'm an avid reader for fun, then that budget of my time can go towards that. But in terms of personal development, getting all my work done, I have to be really disciplined about not spending time on things that are not going to actually help me get to that next level right now. And so you can use AI to find what is the right book or to sort out and maybe figure out. And then it's just a matter of, yeah, what learning, where do I want to go deep? Because it's going to make the biggest difference right now. And that's actually a concept from a book called The One Thing by Gary Kellen is one of my another book I love. He asked this question. I actually have it written right here on my whiteboard still from the time I read the book. It says, what one thing can you do such that if done will make all other things easier or unnecessary? Because at the end of the day, of all the million priorities we have, one of them is truly the most important. There is no equality. It's not all 10 of these have to happen a day. I want them all to happen, but in reality, one of them is the most important. And one domino will cascade more of the subsequent dominoes than another one. And so that's a really helpful framework. And then what Gary Keller does is he would spend 3 to 4 hours every morning blocked off just on that one thing, because he knew that if I do that one thing, everything else gets easier. And so when I think about this problem that you're wrestling with, that we all wrestle with, that's how I like to think about it, is like, I have a list of a billion things that probably should get done. What's the one thing? Maybe it's a relationship. Maybe it's reading a book. Maybe it's a cold plunge today, because today I'm not in a good emotional state and I need to address that.
Right.
But you can't fill your life with like all the wisdom of everyone's like, I got this morning routine and then I'm studying this. And I read a post yesterday on LinkedIn, or maybe it was Twitter. It was like, here's the 7 things you should do every day and your life will be happy. And I was like, no, like, sorry, I don't have a list of 7 things that happen every day ever in my life. So you can do that if that's what you choose to do and you work well that way, great. But most people don't even have the option or flexibility to fill their day with 7 different tasks. If each one of those tasks only takes 30 minutes, that's still a majority of your workday, like, or almost half your workday, I should say. That you can't do that. And then you're just checking boxes. So like, you have to be more dynamic than that. So with that being said, sorry, I sort of rambled on and took us a little bit away from it, but I'm passionate about that side of things. Let's get back to you, Josh. Enough about me. Let's talk about AI, how that's disrupting or how you're using it for some of the projects that you have right now. Anything you're particularly excited about or worried about with AI as it's been developing and as it continues to be a bigger part of our life?
Yeah, you know, much like politics, I think people are kind of drifting into this, you know, is it going to be the end of the world camp, or is it going to be a zero burger camp? And I'm not sure where I fall. The reality lies somewhere in between. And I think you're probably similar in that respect, maybe leaning more towards it's going to be revolutionary. Well, I agree with that. I think it's already been revolutionary. But what it's doing is what it's disrupting is trust, honestly. That's the main thing it's doing. It is a completely innovative technology. It is mind-blowing. It will do stuff that you never thought possible even 18 months ago. However, what it's doing is it's giving everybody, from the smartest people on the planet to the dumbest people on the planet, the ability to produce something that looks kind of acceptable. Which means that as knowledge is commoditized through this tool, which is what it is, so are the people behind it and the people who are using it to try to benefit whatever outcome they're trying to achieve. And if you're in business, so for example, if I'm a really dumb person and not trustworthy and not respectable, but I'm creating all this great content through AI, and I've built this website and this app around this topic that says I can solve all your problems, eventually the market's going to catch up to that, because the people who are still making purchasing decisions are still people. So it's all we're playing is a trust game, and it's just gotten more complicated with AI, you know, because I still need to decide who I'm going to buy my bed sheets from, who I'm going to buy my food from, who I'm going to buy my automation software from, who I'm going to buy my consulting from. All of those things are trust-based decisions And now there's more people out there who can access a database that can put that trust out into the world, but it's making me harder to believe that, or it's making me more dubious that you are who you say you are. So I'm really interested to see that tension, because while the technology is exploding, the adoption is, there's a lag, there's a huge lag. And it'll be really interesting to see how those two things unite between the digital and the real world of physics. And I've been filibustering for a second, but let me know what kind of thoughts that bring.
It aligns to some of the things I believe. I mean, I believe that there will at least be some period of time during the transition, if not even long-term, where humanity is what is scarce and or trust is what is scarce. And thus the marketplace disproportionately has to transact in those areas. If technology makes, let's just say long-term, it makes everything abundant, more or less everything abundant. I mean, capitalism doesn't really work in that world. That's my biggest, maybe one of my more controversial beliefs, is that in the next 10 to 15 years, we're going to totally redesign our government. And like, people hear that and they think, no, there's no way. But I think that at some point, let's maybe not put a time box on it. At some point, when and if AI can do everything better than humans, there's not a competitive marketplace in that world, in most markets. So what'll be interesting is to see what markets form and what then we do with that. I do see a longer term market for exactly what you said, trust, human connection. You know, even if AI can present as a human and is believable, even if a humanoid robot can make the facial expressions, express itself and feels totally human, you cut it open, it still doesn't bleed. So it's not the same thing. And so even if it's a bias, right, which will be an interesting conversation that I think will happen someday down the line, of at what point are robots, you know, worthy of rights and things like that. And it's right. Just a very interesting hypothetical conversation. But for at least the next 10, 15, 20 years, there's going to be this marketplace of, all right, well, if robots can do things as good or better than humans, who do I trust? And that element of humanity seems to be where a lot of the market's going to go, because even that's how I feel now. You know, it's, if I work with a business, who do I trust not to use AI irresponsibly, not to be irresponsible with my data, not to jeopardize my business, not to, there's going to be so many implications of all of this that we'll have to sort through, but it's an exciting time. And so, yeah, I think that you're dead on with this idea of trust. And I think that it'll be interesting to see what markets form around that. I think there might be, you know, similar to like, there's sort of an awakening going on right now around food products and increasing transparency about how are things made and is it healthy? Is it really healthy or is it not healthy? And what does that mean? Does that mean it's no GMOs? Does that mean it's organic? Does that mean it's chemicals or not chemicals or pesticides? It's like most people, as agriculture industrialized, just saw more food, but they don't know what that means. And are they okay with that or not? They got to figure out and decide, right? But mostly they don't even know. Mostly it's like, I don't even know what happens to the food before it shows up in my supermarket. And I don't even know that not all of it is exactly the same quality or not exactly sourced the same way. So it's hard to make a decision that's smart because I don't know what to trust in the food. So there's sort of this trust issue around food where it's like, if it has this label, does that mean it's really safe or that it's really organic or that it's really going to, you know, be healthy for my kids? Everyone's trying to do well, you know, for their family. And so it's like, what does it mean? Well, I think the same way is same thing's happening in technology, where it's like more and more will happen abstracted away. And it's like, am I okay with how that's happening? Do I trust it? And so I love that idea. I think there's a lot to explore there, and I have no idea how exactly it will work out, but I think it's certainly going to be at a premium to have soft skills, to have the ability to communicate and build trust, and to have a brand that people can rely on and trust.
Spencer, I dramatically underestimate what time horizons you're referring to. In the context of AI, I saw your eyes light up as soon as you went into the distant future where you started to make possibilities, possibly dystopian possibilities. But it strikes me that the way the tech is going to evolve is going to revolve around which direction the demand's coming from. And I'm interested in that. So for the foreseeable future, you've got humans who need things. And AI is a tool that can manipulate, innovate, whatever we need as humans to live and thrive. But you're right in that at a certain point, the tech's going to evolve to the point where it's going to be hard to distinguish who's human and who's not human. And again, whether that's 500 years or 50 years remains to be seen, but it will be an interesting question for everybody involved, and does need and demand shift from humans to technology is going to be a really, really fascinating topic that I hope I'm too dead to consider.
I fear you will not be. So I would that would be my advice. Every time I learn or touch base or get experience or rub shoulders with people who are on the forefront of this, I am continually reminded of a couple of things. One is it's going to happen way faster than we think it will, because it's ever accelerating. And so it's technology is ever accelerating. And so what's really hard for us to conceptualize is the fact that mathematically, just this is what the math says. The math says that in the next 100 years, we'll have more technological advancement than in the last 12,000 years. So just using the math that we can, again, it's theoretical. So it's not to say that things couldn't disrupt that math, but there's a longstanding pattern about how fast technology accelerates, how fast compute power accelerates, how fast innovation accelerates. And so as we look at that, we can kind of predictably map out, at least on the theoretical side, and say, I think about how wild our lives have changed over the last 25 years of the internet.
Yeah.
If I knew that itself, if that was just going to be a linear progress and the speed of change of the last 25 years was going to stay the same, that alone is enough to be like, wow, what could life be like in 25 years? Because no piece of 25 years ago, Spencer, could conceptualize a smartphone or any of the stuff that is driving the economy today. Top five tech companies on the S&P 500 account for, I want to say it's like 30 or 50%. It's some massive percent of the revenue of the entire S&P 500. It's massively skewed towards these tech companies at the top. So they didn't even really exist in earnest in the way they do today 25 years ago. And so you look at that, it's like that, just that amount of shift of 25 years ago, I couldn't even imagine how a cell phone would work, really, you know, like early 2000s. It's like, if you saw a car phone, you're like, wow, that's incredible. How do they do it? Does it have a landline? What do you mean they're using radio waves? How does that even work? And then now here we are, where all of the information, more or less of all time, that's been digitized is available to us in our pocket, and we have access to it. We can manipulate it. It's just crazy. It's such a crazy development over 25 years. And to think then of what will be real 25 years from now, I think is, again, once you put in the fact that it's an exponential curve, not a linear curve, it's crazy. Even right now, most people, like if you want to psych yourself out a little bit, go look up the latest, just look up some YouTube videos on some of the latest humanoid robots and just see where those are at. Projection is that there will be billions of humanoid robots by, I think it's either 2030 or 2035, billions. So on par with humanity, number of robots in the next 10 years, you know, roughly. That's the kind of projections that you're like, even if they're way off, I might be underestimating how fast some of the stuff is coming. And even if you just look right now at the robots that have full facial expressions, it's stuff like that where you're like, I didn't even know people were working on this yet, let alone that it's like, actually there's people testing and using it today. So there's just going to be so much disruption. But again, who knows the timeline? It could be much further out, could be much sooner. But it's always one of the things I always come back to when I get deeper and deeper into it to see like, where's it going and how do we use it? I'm always come away with the feeling of, man, I'm probably thinking that it's longer than it is. And I'm probably underestimating how disruptive it's going to be. Those are the two feelings I end up with. But doesn't mean you have to be scared of it. Like at the end of the day, all the upside is in the uncertainty. So it's like,
right?
That's where the upside is. And the upside for humanity. The reality is, if we look at past technology, the way that it makes things abundant raises the standard of living for everyone. So we're gonna do a lot of really good things in the world with technology. But
one thought.
Please.
Well, so there's of course different applications of this. There's robotics, there's intelligence, it extends out almost indefinitely. I think you are right. I think it's gonna hit us faster than we expect. However, how do you account for the pendulum swinging a little bit back towards the here and now and the physical that a lot of people are doing? So for instance, Saturday, I did a cold plunge group. We got into 43 degree water for 5 minutes, and And that group of 25 people represents to me a group of people who are going, hey, the technology's great. We're really excited to have our iPhones. We're also really excited to turn them on and get back out in nature and suffer together for mental health in this case, for physical health in this case. And there's this notion of we could get hung up on the possibilities of technology, and we should, especially as entrepreneurs and business people who need to be on the cutting edge of that and start anticipating what world's going to look like in that rubber the road we should be doing. However, is it possible that also 50 years into the future, all of us as humans are just going to decide we're putting our AI on do not disturb because we're going fly fishing or we're cold plunging or we're going running because our physical needs and our relational needs haven't changed?
Yeah. That's a great question. So I think about that through two kind of ideas. The first one is, if I'm prepared for a world where that doesn't happen, then I will thrive in any world. So
there you go.
I can thrive today in the world we have today. So if things stay more like today, then what I'm doing is going to keep working. So I need to prepare for the potential changes that the sort of worst case scenario, because anything short of that is actually even better for me. But that doesn't really address the question you asked, which is, do you think there will be sort of this swing away from technology? 100%. That is where, when I say I think humanity is what becomes scarce and thus the marketplace goes to that, it's kind of like in Nordic countries where they've equalized between the sexes opportunity as much as possible. They've seen an increase in polarization of people voluntarily choosing to lean into more sort of gender-specific type activities or some of their preferences, right? When you see that, it's counterintuitive, but I think that it's also predictable. It's a little bit predictable to say, once you take all the pressure off, once you eliminate certain things, you end up in a world where, by choice, you are going to reconnect with certain parts of yourself, or you're going to prioritize certain parts of yourself. So in a world where technology is no longer the novel, scarce thing that everyone's excited to have, and let me go see the new thing, and it becomes ubiquitous, the ultimate luxury is not needing it. The ultimate luxury is disconnecting from it. The ultimate luxury is reconnecting with your humanity, connecting with other humans, having these deeply human experiences that are now more scarce. If we get to 2050 and there's the projected number of robots at that time, where we are literally the minority on this planet compared to robots, well, then that will become the thing that's special. And so what will that mean for assuming, let's say we don't fully replace capitalism. I think long-term there's going to be some sort of reckoning on capitalism, just because I don't think it can work. As someone who loves capitalism, I think it's the best system ever invented. I just don't think it can work in a world where there's no competition on labor leverage or technological leverage, because AI is better than all. So in that dystopian environment, there's going to be some need for change of how we evaluate resources and access to things. But that all being said, if there is still marketplaces, and I tend to think there will be in some form, the marketplace is going to be around what's scarce. You know, it's like, so it's going to be around humanity, connection, these types of experiences, experiential things that are more rare or harder to come by, that you can't, no matter how much productivity AI can increase per person and robotics could increase per person, you could have near infinite levels of output. You still have a scarcity of, like, your presence. Now, even again, look, if you want to talk to some of the AI optimists, they'll say, yeah, but we're going to hook up to your brain. You can transport yourself into avatars. You can, all this stuff they anticipate. And great, let's say all of it happens. I think there will always be, to your point, some level of, what does it mean to be human? What experiences are scarce there? And so it'll be interesting to see what happens. And so I think we could very much end up in that world. If we do, I think we'll thrive, because that's a world we understand well. The human world, I think we understand. We've got thousands of years of evolution to understand. The technology world, I think we are moving at a speed where we not only don't understand it, but won't be able to understand it at the speed it develops, which is an interesting conundrum to have.
You know, thinking of your worst case scenario, as long as technology also produces lightsabers in addition to all the droids and robots, I'll be happy. I'll still be a happy.
There you go.
The technological app.
And I mean, if it produces the kind of lifespans they're projecting and have the breakthroughs on the medical side where we can live indefinitely or very long lives, I mean, it's a lot of good things that can come from it. And then life doesn't even become scarce. So then we have a whole new set of problems to deal with. It's just the whole thing. it's so fun. It's so fun to think about it because the possibilities are so wild. But to your point, we have what we have today. We still have to operate in that environment. And as we take steps towards it, I just think that the thought exercise opens our minds to what's possible, helps us not get surprised by the future. And that becomes a really high leverage skill, because now I'm not scared of the future. There's so much fear in the unknown. And so if it's like, oh no, what could possibly happen? Then now I'm scared of it. And so I shy away from it. I don't adopt AI. I don't try to use it in my daily life. I don't lean into the new tech. But if I understand it, I'm like, it's a tool. Here's how I'm going to use it. Here's how I'm not going to use it. Here's the role it can or should play in my life, or I don't want it to. I'm in control because I'm not living in that state of fear. And maybe that's, maybe that's the best place for us to close out. Is I'll turn it over to you and you can share any final thoughts. You know, what has you optimistic about the future? What has you focused on the good in the world, the good in your life, optimistic about where things are going, irrespective of AI? What has you the most excited, and how can people help contribute to your vision of the future?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been blown away recently by the amount of good people doing good things out there, expecting nothing in return. And that has me incredibly positive. We've gotten really isolated over the last couple of years. I work out of basement office with heater on, and I have to force these opportunities to interact with good people. And since launching Luff Sheets, I've talked to so many organizations that build beds for kids I didn't know about, more reaching. There's a huge demand for sheets out there. So what I didn't realize is just on the other side of a phone call or an email, there's oftentimes a good person, and that has me enormously optimistic until the robots come. So secondly, and related to that, is we're trying to restore some of those personal relationships. And if that's the kind of thing you're interested in, check out tripoli.io. We are launching for beta towards the end of March, I believe. And we would love to have you on there if you're the kind of person who's serious about networking and would like to just meet with somebody. And you can do that with us. So, Spencer, I'm stoked to be here, buddy. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Josh. Stay in touch, and good luck with all the good that you are doing out there, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, before you go, I have a small request. Our mission is to empower as many people as possible to maximize their potential through the power of leverage. Could you help us in this mission by leaving a review on iTunes, Spotify, or YouTube? And if you know just one person who would benefit from today's episode, would you please share it with them? Your support means the world to us, and we are thrilled to have you in the community. Thank you for being a part of our journey and helping us grow. You can find show notes for today's show and past shows at lessonsinleverage.com. which also has links to connect with me personally and connect with our various podcast channels across your favorite social networks. A big thanks to Solve.cloud, who sponsored this episode. They're a group of expert consultants that help SaaS and financial services companies to implement, optimize, and manage Salesforce.com. They can help you with custom integration solutions and are helping customers to implement some of the most important generative AI technologies. You can find them at Solve.cloud. That's SOLVD.cloud is the URL. Thanks again. I'll talk.